Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The big travel season is almost here. Are you headed to the usual European locale, maybe Australia and South Korea or even Taiwan, China or Nepal? What about Dubai or Vietnam? Before the Cold War, pleasure travel to such exotic places was almost unthinkable. But it's more popular than ever. And since 1989, the increase in tourism travel has been staggering. Last year alone, some 1 billion people around the world numbered as tourists. What's behind the revolution? Joining us now to talk about that is Elizabeth Becker, an author, former foreign editor at NPR, and a former New York Times correspondent. Elizabeth Becker has reported on international and national affairs for the New York Times and the Washington Post, and is the author of the classic When the War Was Over, A History of the Khmer Rouge and Modern Cambodia. Her new book is called Overbooked: The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
It's good to be here, Anne.
You begin your book with the story of your own mother, and it contrasts nicely with the individual traveler, with the gigantic industry that has grown up around her and the many millions like her. But still, at its root, travel's personal.
Yes, and my mom was a spark for some of this book. After my father died and she battled cancer, she looked around and she said, I haven't really been around the world. And so she sold the family home. And in those days, it was enough money to start traveling. And by the time she died, she had gone to every continent except Antarctica. And it had really made that last part of her life spectacular. And I mention it to show that it's very personal for all of us. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to leave the impression, as I write about the industry, that I didn't recognize how personal it was and how dear people hold their travel privileges.
Because we talk about the travel bug all the time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, once people start, they can't stop.
Yeah, and it's there are all kinds of ways to travel, but at the root, it is an ability to jump out of your life, experience new things, see new things, and hopefully appreciate what you have when you get home. That's sort of the general virtuous circle of travel.
You know, you talk about the travel business and how it's exploded since the end of the Cold War. Is that as simple as an equation as the fact that there are just more places to travel now?
Several things. Certainly, in hindsight, it makes all the sense in the world. The end of the Cold War meant opening borders, and few industries require open borders more than travel and tourism. That's one. Two is all kinds of technological revolutions. The long-haul airplane has played a huge role in this, that now you can go from Dubai nonstop to Washington, D.C. That would never have happened, you know, a couple decades ago. Then there's the whole communications internet revolution, the ability to make your own plans with the click of the computer keys and book an apartment in Barcelona, that sort of thing. It's it just made travel easier. And then the third point, of course, is the cost. The cost has gone way down relative to the earlier days when travel was an elite pleasure.
My guest is Elizabeth Becker. She's the author of Overbooked: Exploring the Business of Travel and Tourism. If you have a question or comment for Elizabeth, want to tell us where you're headed this year and maybe get some insights from Elizabeth, who spent 5 years researching for this book, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. 5 years you spent working on preparing or researching for this book. Where did you go and what did you do?
Well, oddly enough, the way I started out was looking at the travel writing side of the industry. I had a nice fellowship at Harvard Shorenstein Center, and I wanted to see why the travel section was always full of, you know, good news and never any real critique of travel. And in that way, I discovered that the big elephant in the room, so to speak, is the growth of the industry. So I sort of went to every continent, picking a country that would most easily reflect certain issues that I knew were important. I went to Zambia, which I fell in love with, the wildlife preserves there, and discovered how much philanthropy was important in Africa, reviving the wildlife parks. I went to Dubai and Abu Dhabi, the center of Middle East tourism and consumer tourism, China, Sri Lanka, Cambodia, in all kinds of places in Europe and in South America, to Brazil and Costa Rica and Belize, and then up to Mexico and, of course, the United States, from Washington to Hawaii.
And another part of it is with the end of the Cold War, it wasn't just that we were able, Americans were able to travel in more places. More people from other places that had never been able to travel before were cut loose.
Exactly. And I use China as the obvious example because it is the giant in tourism now. The you know, the Chinese could barely move within their own country during much of the rule of Mao Zedong. When Deng Xiaoping came to power and wanted to open up to the world and do reforms and become part of, you know, essentially the free enterprise system of the world, he trained his people to be tourists. They had a specific program where they developed tourism within China, big tour buses, visiting spots that the Chinese had never seen, most of them, all over the country, and in creating a whole new idea of being a tourist. And then he instituted, the government instituted paid vacations, and they're called Golden Weeks in Chinese. So we had about at least 10 years of learning how to be a tourist. Then, then the next part is you go overseas. And so the first countries who were sort of the guinea pigs were nearby Australia and New Zealand. And I have some, I just think some fascinating and often funny stories about what it's like to train Chinese tourists in your country, and as told through the Australian tourism minister.
So China takes tourism very, very seriously, but the U.S., as a political entity, doesn't pay much attention to it.
Oh, it's very purposeful. The head in the sand approach. It's tourism in just at the dawn of globalization in 1995. Tourism got caught up in the whole big Republican versus Democrat ideas of the size of government and the role of government. Newt Gingrich, if you remember, was the new Speaker of the House,
mm-hmm.
and he declared that the government should get out of tourism.
Was this part of the contract with America?
Exactly. And at the same time, President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore had held the first, and it turned out the last, White House conference on tourism to say that the issue is not small or big, but the issue is smart. And tourism is a smart 21st century industry that should be promoted by the United States because it creates so many jobs. Right today, it's something like 1 out of 11 jobs in the world are through tourism.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, tourism takes advantage of the new internet. In 1995, it was new. And the Democrats lost. The Republicans essentially zeroed the tourism budget out of the tourism money out of the budget in its office and within the Department of Commerce. And to this day, the United States has a small, essentially statistical office with only a small bit of policy on tourism. And there's a hostility on the Republican Party side in particular against either promoting tourism, organizing tourism, or making sure tourism follows certain kinds of regulations to ensure that works both for the environment and for the local people.
It's a sort of the same attitude at the international level. Correct me if I'm wrong, but United Nations doesn't pay much attention to it either.
You're slightly wrong.
Okay.
The United Nations has its smallest office, but still it has office is United Nations World Tourism Organization. Okay. And that it's headquartered in Madrid, and it is the one place where I start out my book going there, because it's the one place that looks at it with a critical eye, mm-hmm. and describes the industry. The other important thing about the UN's World Tourism Organization is it worked with the industry, a group of called the World Travel and Tourism Council, which is the top executives of the industry, to create a system to measure how much money is spent on tourism. It's called satellite accounts, and I won't go into the nitty-gritty details that I'm not sure I understand about the formula, but it's a way for countries to keep track of how much money tourists spend when they come and visit. And that's how I was able to say, I was able to quote the figures, $6.4 trillion, that's trillion dollars, is contributed to the global economy every year by travel and tourism.
Do we know how much of that is spent in the United States?
We do, and the figure just went out of my head.
Okay. This isn't a test, so
no.
We can get back to that. Later.
Yeah, but it is one of the top sectors, and I think that's one of the reasons last week you saw Congress move so quickly.
Huh.
To put an end to the furloughs, because Memorial Day kicks off the vacation season.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that we would hobble one of our most important sectors terrified them. And the industry, was behind. The industry is not out front all the time, but, there's no doubt that that was not just Republican versus Democrat. That was everybody saying, we can't afford to hobble our tourism industry.
So they get that, but they don't have any larger goals as a nation to improve it, to curry it, and that sort of thing.
No, well, the thing is that tourism is, to a lot of people, is frivolous. It's, people like to make fun of tourists looking goofy. You've heard all those jokes.
Don't tell Rick Steves.
He knows that probably better than anybody else. they say, We're not going to promote tourism, even though, as I point out repeatedly, tourism, the product of tourism is a country. And a government that doesn't accept this and go with it is causing itself headaches. So that when I went to several of these trade fairs for tourism, you had countries like Thailand with a beautiful booth, great brochures for the whole country, dancers, music, and then you'd have the U.S. section way off to the side, and you'd have this string of rather less spectacular booths from Maine or California or Ohio promoting their particular brand of tourism, but there's no one American booth, and that was a visual symbol of what happens here in the United States.
My guest is Elizabeth Becker. She is the author of Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, 57 degrees with cloudy skies and a chance of rain, a high near 70 today, partly cloudy tonight and a low of 52. Support for 89.7 comes from the State Auto Insurance Companies, providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com. And support comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, in association with Catco as Kids. Presenting Boats, from Australia's Terrapin Puppet Theater, this family-friendly high seas adventure features actors using puppets, acrobatics, and sound effects. May 3rd through the 5th in Studio One at the Rife Center. Tickets and details at wexarts.org. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest this hour is Elizabeth Becker. She's author of Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. If you have a question, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Some 1 billion people around the world were tourists last year. Were you one of them? Give us a call. What do you think? Did you go someplace more exotic than you ever thought you would? Maybe, say, 20 or 30 years ago? Give us a call and tell us why. 614-292-8513. You write, well, so I wonder, was there any way to measure, Elizabeth, the lost opportunity because the United States doesn't market tourism in a unified way?
Oh, sure. The industry market did a full report on it called The Last Decade, and they counted something like 440,000 lost jobs, billions of dollars in lost revenue, and a plea that that as the United States comes to terms with their security requirements after 9/11, they also consider how you welcome travelers into the United States, because there was a big drop in tourists from Europe and Japan, the tourists who spend the most money because they felt insulted by the way they were treated at our airports. And lots of funny and lots of dark examples of people who were turned away.
Like,
and
how? What do you mean how they were treated?
Well, you know, they would be pulled aside and searched. Some of the men strip searched. There were examples of tourists who accidentally overstayed their visa and were thrown in jail. And this was all over the internet. It just kept piling up and piling up. So then it wouldn't. They're particularly in British newspapers, because they have that sort of smarty pants attitude. Anyhow, they had regaled their readers with all kinds of stories of people being felt very insulted and did not want to go back to the United States. And then the visa requirements had changed. And it's not that they weren't complaining about the security requirements. Okay. It was that the sense of being guilty before being proved innocent. And this came up in a very huge way in 2009 with President Obama and his wife going to Copenhagen to plead the case for Chicago to be the site of the Summer Olympics. Huh. And when he was there talking to the committee, one of the members said, we can't choose the United States because we're not sure the athletes would get through your border requirements. So it's the Obama administration has, you know, without dropping security, has made a more friendly welcome. They've opened up visas for a lot of countries, added consulates where you can get a visa in China and Brazil, which are two of the hottest countries for sending people out as tourists. So it's a difficult history here.
We like to think of ourselves as a much more open country and that other countries are much harder to get around in, but it's just the problem of getting into the United States more than anything.
Yeah, it's like the United States is this gorgeous country, but it doesn't make any difference if you can't come in and see the Grand Canyon and go to New Orleans, et cetera. And that was the issue. And it's one of the other issue, of course, is how do you find out where you want to go? And that was the other problem. We, until a year or so ago, we did not have a national website. So if you were in, say, Malaysia, no, there's none. And as it is, it's rather new, and so it's not quite what you'd want. But it took an act of Congress to get that. And it was slow. It was really heavy lifting for a while. And so if you're in Malaysia, you want to know how you go by train from Boston to Washington, you don't know that the name of our train system is Amtrak. Or you want to go to Chicago, and how far is Chicago from Detroit? And all these questions, there was no way to find out, because you either went to the state tourism website or there was no other. So that problem was solved.
I guess I was kind of surprised when I was entertaining some Egyptian women some years ago, and they were here with some group some government type group. And I took them for a trip down to southern Ohio to see, you know, some really beautiful places there. And they were absolutely shocked. They thought Ohio was strictly farmland and cities. They had no idea there were these beautiful places.
Yeah.
And here they're visiting from around the world. And I thought, well, how did you prepare for this trip? Didn't anybody tell you?
Yeah, and it's very hard to find that information. So, and people say, well, if you don't, the critics and are say, well, if they don't know enough about the United States, it's not going to help to have a website. Well, not true. And and I don't know how it's, there's preparation for a trip is one of the most important things about modern travel. People, the more you prepare, you know, the more you're going to enjoy the trip. And that's part of the downside I found in this is that if you don't understand where you're going, you can pick the wrong trip. And I think all of your listeners can tell you the time they got into some really questionable, sketchy hotel far, far from the beach and didn't speak the language and couldn't figure out how to get from X to Y and did not have a memorable vacation.
Or memorable for all the wrong reasons.
Yes, exactly.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Elizabeth Becker, author of Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. And Tom in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Tom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have the Middle East Peace Foundation here in central Ohio. And it offers aspects of international law between Israel and the Palestinians in a confederation that would need a suggested framework, which has been informally approved, an end game, and the end game is peace through tourism. I wanted to get your insight into whether this kind of strategy has a good possibility. The logic behind my choosing peace through tourism is many of the ideas that you have brought up, particularly that what is good for tourism is good for business, and what is good for business is good for the peace. And I was wondering if you could comment on a framework. I find the Israelis and the Palestinians very personable and very cordial to meet with, and that's a common ground in which I think they can build an economic interest through foreign tourism.
Hmm. Elizabeth Becker?
Yes, well, you're not alone on that. Peace through tourism is I explore in my chapter on Sri Lanka. And it's a rocky road, and it requires a government that will listen to all communities. And that hasn't happened yet in Sri Lanka, but they're hoping a lot of the people with your kinds of ideas are hoping that tourism can bring together the communities in Sri Lanka after the war. Now, I have to tell you, I do go through tourism between Christian Bethlehem and Israel, and it's not a good story. Essentially, because of the wall built by Israel, you have to go through Israel to get to Christian Bethlehem, and it's causing a lot of problems in sort of Christian pilgrimages. And the industry has really embraced religious pilgrimages. I spend a lot of time talking about the Hajj, and sometimes what's good for the business is good for tourism, but not always. And what I'm trying to say is what's good for the locals is usually good for tourism, and that's the way you build your industry. But in order to make tourism in the Middle East, you'd have to get the two sides to agree to open up the territories and have a larger freedom of movement, which you know quite well doesn't exist yet.
All right. Once again, we're back to that movement issue. Tom, thanks for your call. You know, listening to you talk about the pilgrimages and so forth, I suppose that was practically the original tourism was the religious pilgrimages.
Absolutely. And it remains the Hajj is the single biggest travel event of the year still to this day. And the old the religious pilgrimage in Spain, which is now World Heritage Site, is one of the most traveled as well. And if it's done with the religious aspect, it's very moving. If it's done with the see this, see that, it becomes just another part of tourism. But yes, religious pilgrimage was the first real human desire to go someplace, not for commerce, not for political reasons, but just as a tourist.
And you mentioned that France is the original tourist capital of the world and still is in the top.
Yeah, the original tourists were the English who, as we all know, traveled all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And one of their first stops was across the channel to France. And France developed a tourism industry, and then in the 1930s became the first country to give paid vacations. And that sort of started the ball rolling. They had quite a bit of a tourism industry until World War II. And then after the war, when the United States started the Marshall Plan to help rebuild Europe, the French and the Americans decided the best way to get France back on its feet was to rebuild the tourism industry, something that I was surprised to discover when I was doing my research. And then they added the Ministry of Culture, and they sort of pioneered this bottom-up thing where everything that builds French tourism now is more or less dictated from the locals, with an incredible amount of coordination with transportation, all those trains and buses and planes, and all to retain what is French in their character. French vineyards, French landscapes, French cities, French countryside, that sort of thing.
But on the other hand, you know, a neighbor of mine, her daughter's planning to go to France, and they were going to go to spend a little bit more time in Paris, but now they've cut it back to 2 days because they say, really, Paris? A lot of lines, and everything's in English anyways. There's not really, you don't get a lot of that, you know, experience as a student, so they're going to be more in the south of France. Is that becoming much of an issue?
Oh, of course. I mean, we go back to that first thing we talked about, 1 billion tourists. And as much as France tries, of course, you're going to have long lines, particularly in the summertime. So they're absolutely correct. Now, not everybody speaks French, and if you get out of the main tourist spots of the Eiffel Tower and Notre Dame Church and that sort of thing, you're going to be able to find it. But the more you get out in the countryside, absolutely, the more you get to know France, what they call La France profonde, the deepest expression of what it is to be French.
Steve and Marion, you're on the air with Elizabeth Becker. Welcome
yes.
to the show, Steve.
Thank you very much, and thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question is kind of along the lines of what she was saying about the U.S. not being very supportive of tourism as a whole. And I guess my question is about natural areas. I mean, I see, like, even in Ohio, our natural areas that would be a good place to go, like, you know, Mohegan State Forest or any of our state parks, are under, you know, a lot of attack from oil and gas industry and logging. And it seems like it's kind of like the thing they say about, you know, white man's logic is that unimproved land, you know, has little value. And if you look at that on a national level, I keep hearing these stories that our national parks are being bought up by the Chinese. And I just wondered, is there any truth to that, that a lot of our natural areas are would-be tourist attractions that we've had out west, that the Chinese are buying a lot of these up? And I just wanted to ask if she knows if that was true.
Elizabeth Becker?
Oh, no, that's not true. I think that's a confusion of two different things that are going on. The Chinese are buying up a lot of land in other countries, but our national park system is not in any threat of being purchased by foreigners. But the way commerce does enter is, as you just said, through the allowing logging or mineral exploitation, and that comes down to you just put your finger on an interesting point about tourism: how to protect the wildlife by making tourism the economic engine. And the country that figured that one out early was Costa Rica.
Huh. The ecotourism.
Yeah, ecotourism. That's called monetizing the trees and the wildlife. I mean, they figure out how much a bird flying through the forest is worth. And that's what, you know, a lot of really amazing people are doing on the tourism side. You know, we can protect and preserve our wildlife areas, not just the national parks, by being really smart about the kind of tourists we bring in and really examining how we help the local economies make money through that. Now, one of the examples where it works in an interesting way is in New England, where they have saved a lot of the old red barns because they figured that they figured out that that's one of the reasons people come to in the fall to look at the foliage. And so you have a red barn autumn foliage tourism circuit. And that's the sort of ingenuity that's needed, and it's hard to do without sort of government support, either at the local or higher level.
Well, there's been a lot of cutbacks at state parks and national parks because of the sequestration at state parks because of huge budget cuts at the state level.
Mm-hmm. And that's where some local industry could kick in and say, okay, we can add some money by figuring out some very cool way to market this. And that's where you need some sort of synergy that I don't think costs a lot of money, but takes a little brain work.
I think you wrote about, you know, in terms of unchecked tourism, is it the city of, Cambodia has a big problem because the resorts are all springing up where they used to grow food.
Well, yeah, and this is where Steve was just talking about the Chinese. The Chinese are buying up a lot of the land in Cambodia for plantations, and also foreign buyers are buying up property along the coast that used to be their equivalent of state parks and building hotels and things there. So I said that in one stretch of land, if you're on vacation, you're having fun on what used to be the property of fishermen and villagers who were thrown out in order to make a tourist enclave. And that's the dark side of tourism, is that often a government will create so-called new economic zones that, in fact, are just taking up the land.
I always kind of wondered about Haiti when I heard people were going down to one of the resorts. They said they were fabulous, but you had to know that on the other side of the island was the abject poverty.
Well, and in Haiti, what has happened is that there's one part of the country that is like a Club Med that is only visited by cruise ships, and it's not really Haiti. And it's what's called a tourist zone, and those are popping up all over the place.
Thank you, Steve, for that call. We appreciate it. My guest is Elizabeth Becker. She's the author of Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. We'll get to maybe some of the darker sides of that when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the question over Syria. Chemical weapons use has been charged the red line, but uncertain. Should the U.S. intervene? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 57 degrees with cloudy skies, a slight chance of a light rain today and a high of 67. Partly cloudy for tonight and a low of 52. Mostly sunny for Tuesday, a nice day with a high of 77 degrees. Support for 89.7 comes from Home Care Assistance. In home care for older adults with a philosophy promoting health, well-being, and quality of life for all clients, no matter their limitations. Information on Home Care Assistance is at 481-8888. That's 481-8888. And support comes from the Columbus Foundation, thanking WOSU and others who make Columbus a smart and open community. At the Columbus Foundation, personal service and community pride combine to help donors help others through impactful philanthropy, big or small. It's here that history resounds and opportunity abounds. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Elizabeth Becker, author of Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. Have you traveled somewhere exotic lately that you never imagined you would be able to travel maybe 20 or 30 years ago? Want to tell us about it? 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Of course, you can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Email from Chris. Chris writes, as you look at the travel industry, where do you see youth travel going, ages 18 to 30 years? To what extent might such trends as gap years, ecotourism, and mission or service-oriented travel provide an opportunity to create new travelers who become lifetime travelers?
Good question. I looked into this quite a bit, and as in many parts of the industry, there are fuzzy figures on all of this, but there's a good part of this and a worrying part of it. The good part is that the youth are very careful with their money, and that means they tend to have a light footprint when they travel. They are very keen to get close to locals rather than go from air-conditioned hotel room to air-conditioned hotel room, and they're doing a lot of research before they go someplace. The worrisome part is they're not spending much time when they get there. In the olden days, when I was young, if you had a year abroad, it was a year. And if you did a service, you were gone for at least a summer. And nowadays, it's, you know, you're lucky if someone stays for a month. And
well, what's driving that? Why is that changing?
Part of it is just a general pace of life. Hmm. People don't want to make that commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, you're not going to learn the language, you're not going to learn the culture, and you're not going to have the deep experience that you want. The other thing is that I think Americans are just now starting to realize that they can't go overseas and necessarily earn money speaking, teaching English as they did in the olden days. And so they are going to have to do a lot more of their homework. Now, I think universities, you're in a university town, mm-hmm. Could help a little bit by encouraging longer than, you know, a semester or a quarter overseas, encouraging more language studies. Now on ecotourism, I think that's where I see a lot more in-depth, and I don't know why this is, but I have a nephew that spent a year in a farm tourism, an agro-tourism program in Australia that was fabulous. Now, he didn't have to learn a new language on that one.
Mm-hmm.
Italy has some great agro-tourism, and it's when you go and visit people who are in your same profession or your same interest group that I think you really do delve deeply, and all studies show that if you got to know one country well, you're going to be a better traveler than if you just sort of skim the surface of many countries.
Mike and Hilliard, you're on the air. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you, Ann. Elizabeth, Columbus is the second biggest city in the United States without a train station. How important is a train station to travel and tourism?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question. I'm a train buff. You know, I don't understand what's happened to the Midwest. I'm originally from Iowa, and I grew up with a train station in my small little town, and mm-hmm. they're all gone. I think Amtrak barely skims the southern part of Iowa. Trains are very important because who wants to rent a car in the United States, have to read a map and go from here and there and everywhere? So a lot of tourists end up going wherever the airplane goes. And then unless they have family or friends, they're not going to go to Columbus, mm-hmm. I don't think. And so trains are very important, and that's what I learned on the research on France. The French are very careful that every part of their country is reachable by train for exactly that reason. That's the only way you're going to ensure that the tourist is going to go throughout the country and not just a few well-worn paths.
Thank you for that question, Mike. Appreciate it. Sex tourism is a huge problem on the human level. Are there some countries to look out for in that regard? What are you seeing out there?
Well, there are a lot. Southeast Asia that we already talked about. Eastern Europe, the Caribbean, and to find out, just go on the internet, and you'll find all these websites that are just barely disguised how-tos for sex tourism. And in terms of what responsible governments and organizations look for, they look for help to prevent the underage child who is sold by family or kidnapped to be put into brothels. And it is just, it's so revolting personally to be in a beautiful spot and see someone the age of a grandfather with a young girl and know that she has to spend the night with him for $50.
Is that legal?
No, and it's not legal, and the State Department, among other governments, is working very hard to educate Americans going overseas and then to cooperate in arresting Americans who break the law. But in a lot of countries, police will turn their eye. There'll be ways to get around it. The hotel clerk or the concierge will know what a certain kind of question means, and so on and so forth. So it still flourishes, but it is, underage children are totally illegal.
And so when it comes to traveling, if I'm traveling in Vietnam or somewhere in Southeast Asia and I see something like that that I think looks fishy, what would I do?
Well, in Cambodia, which I know the best, the certain modes of transportation will give you a telephone number. You can talk to the hotel. You can talk to the police. And you can point out what's going on. Everybody says do not try to buy someone out of that. That doesn't work. But to try to reach authorities. And you can also tell your embassy.
Okay. Do we know how big that business is now?
The department, our current State Department and Justice Department say it's responsible for just ridiculously large amounts of money in all kinds of countries, and it's very hard to control. It's when again, the end of the Cold War, opening up the borders. Sadly, it also opened up human trafficking. So human trafficking for sex, human trafficking for labor. And it's very hard to get your arms around it.
And is the revenue from that included in the $6.4 trillion that you cited earlier?
Excuse me, no, but the industry certainly understands that it's part of it. As I said, what's illegal is underage.
Mm-hmm.
It is legal to have brothels in a lot of countries. And during the recession, I think it was the Czech Republic. I write in the book about a former Eastern European country that the parliament, their Congress, voted to make prostitution more legal so they wouldn't lose the tourism industry. And of young men coming from countries like Great Britain, and they wanted to keep that coming as part of their economic recovery program. So it's spoken about openly. I went to one big tourism conference in Brazil where one of the big hoteliers said, let's get serious. A lot of these guys, they go to a country to have a good time and to get laid. So they openly talk about it.
You talk about the often cozy relationship between the travel industry and the media and that there are only a few exceptions to that. First of all, can you describe what you mean by that relationship? What's wrong with it? What are we not getting that we should be?
Well, travel writing is one of the few that I have ever seen where the industry pays the writer to go and write about, like, their resort. So I mentioned Florida, which is pioneered this, where if you're a travel writer in London, they'll pay your airfare over, you get your hotel room free, you get all your meals free, and then you go back and you write a story as if, you know, you're a objective observer. Mm-hmm. Without saying, all of this trip was paid for by the industry. So I would say a majority of the travel articles you might read in the United States are sponsored this way. It's unauthorized advertisements. And that's one of the many reasons why you never see critical travel stories that says, well, I went to, you know, this city and it was boring as all get out, and the hotels were way overpriced, and you never read anything like that. It's always lovely, lovely, lovely. Now, I talked to the freelancers who do this, and they're almost all freelancers. How does it work? And they said it's very open. They court the industry to get their free trips. And they said there'd be no travel writing if there weren't free trips, because who can afford to do it? And so the New York Times, Condé Nast Traveler, people like Rick Steves, you know, they pay their own way. Most of the guides and so on and so forth. And the minimum, can you imagine if the Democratic Party paid the political reporters who went to their convention, the Republican Party paid the political reporters who went to the convention, you would not get objective reporting. So what I argue in the book is that a minimum, when a travel writer does accept a free trip, does write it up for, say, an Ohio newspaper, the travel writer should, at a minimum, explain that this trip was entirely paid for by the industry, so you know that this is the equivalent of an advertisement.
Well, on the other hand, I mean, to go to some of those resorts, it's so expensive. Most places won't send you. Most publications can't afford it themselves anymore.
Right. And so then what's the answer? The answer is the same answer it is for every other issue. The local writes the freelance reporter instead of sending someone on an expensive trip. I mean, that's the way every other issue is handled. So, and so adamant about this for my book, I did not take a single free trip from a hotel or airlines or anything like that.
Were you offered?
Well, you could have, sure. I mean, I could have, but I stopped the conversation before I got there. And in the one instance where I stayed at a hotel where the hotelier was the brother of a good friend of mine, instead of paying him, I contributed to his charity. This was in Sri Lanka. And I think it's just normal journalism. It's not any better or any, it's the same way we are as journalists. We have to pay our own way.
I remember visiting some pyramids in Mexico some years ago. You know, there's the sun and the moon ones, and there's some in the jungles over by the resorts and stuff. And they let you walk all over them. And I was shocked. I felt that, you know, in some of them you couldn't go in and do any kind of flash photography, which I was amazed that they wouldn't let you do that, but they let you crawl all over them. And there were lots of people all over them. Our country is becoming more sophisticated about what they let people trample?
Yes and no. I don't know if you remember, about a year or so ago, a cave, I think it was France, Mediterranean, was closed off to tourists because just the people coming in and breathing were deteriorating the primitive cave art. There are lots of places in Asia where you are now getting more of closing off. It depends solely on the government, because these World Heritage sites are entrusted with the government. And I bring up Cambodia because the temples of Angkor, while some archaeologists, there's a group of foreign archaeologists who are doing a magnificent job preserving, studying the temples, the government is allowing an overwhelming number of tourists to visit with no attempt at keeping the numbers down. Too many hotels are being built up. And when you see the tourists, you see tour guides banging the beautiful temple carvings with sticks to explain this, that, and the other. People are walking all over it. And these are temples that were never meant for anything but, you know, the priests and a small group of the elite. So I have no idea how they're going to survive. Now, the archaeologist says they're repairing, but what's going to be left in the end? And then coincidentally, with all these hotels, modern tourists are one of the biggest users of water, showers, toilets, et cetera, swimming pools, golf courses, so that the water table is drying up, and the foundations of the temples are shifting and, in some cases, vulnerable to collapse, according to some Cambodian archaeologists who are quite concerned.
Hi, Denny. We have just a minute or so. You're welcome to the show.
Okay. I tuned in a little late. I had a Khmer friend, Cambodian friend, used to work for me here, so I've traveled Cambodia, and it was a blessing to be able to go with a native guy who knew everything. Angkor Wat, I think people should go there. And I understand what you're saying about the, it was kind of worrisome because you can go anywhere. You can crawl on anything that you can physically get up to. And, but I didn't, I don't want to, I didn't hear, do you think it's relatively safe to travel Cambodia, Vietnam, Laos, places like that?
Yeah, I generally, yes, I think the question isn't safe. I think it's being a conscientious visitor, like it sounds like you were. And you're absolutely right. Going with a Cambodian as your guide is the perfect way, and I envy you having that as your first experience. It's safe. I think there's been a spate of awful news about tourists getting off the beaten path, and I think murders, rapes, that sort of thing. And in all the instances, there were people who just weren't using common sense in a sense. I'm not blaming them, but I'm just saying that you're foreigners. You don't speak the language often. Be with a local as you were. Listen to experts and don't go off the beaten path. I know that for young people, that's a hard thing to accept, but there's the 1 billion tourists, but there are also 7 billion people, and people are knocking into each other.
Thank you, Denny, for that call. We appreciate it. And Elizabeth Becker, we appreciate your time today so much. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Elizabeth Becker, we've been talking about her new book. It's called Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.